Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. Today, another Empowerment Hour, we're going to begin with a look at nutrients that can make a difference in our lives. Now, I'm going to talk about curcumin in a new way. We know that it helps repair DNA, it helps block cancer cells in the body from becoming full cancers or malignant. But there's something else it does that's really remarkable. I'll tell you about that. Then, for those in the audience who eat meat, and a lot of people in this audience eat meat, and some people eat what they call non-factory farm or organic meat, and others, they just eat any kind of meat they want. Well, according to Alternet, there was an in-depth investigative report that took a year to do from the Kansas City Star newspaper. And then they took a look at how the meat is actually processed. This is important for everyone, for vegans like myself, or for vegetarians, or animal eaters. You're not going to believe what they're doing, the meat industry, to the meat. I'll share that with you. There was some concern about 6 months ago that multiple vitamins really didn't help us prevent cancer or help us really be healthy. Now, I've been challenging these studies for the past 15 years, about twice a year. A study is published. It's a never well-designed study. Almost always when you track it back, you'll find the pharmaceutical industry fingerprints all over the development and funding of the study. Well, I want to challenge the study and show you that multiple vitamins do prevent cancer, do help you if you have cancer, and I'll share the study I'm going to cite. Green tea does a lot for cancer. I'll get on to that. Want to help lower anxiety? Sure. DHA, the omega-3 fatty acids, does that. How to lower your risk of bladder cancer? Protect it. Tell you what can be done with that. And a new study showing that complementary medicine really does help arthritis patients. Now, I didn't have a chance yesterday. Time was limited. But today I will share a commentary, a short one, that will be put out as a part of our series of showing how we have a grossly failed judicial system in this country. If you're wealthy, it works one way to your advantage. If you're not, it works against you, almost always. Glenn Greenwald, HSBC, Too Big to Jail, and the U.S. Two-Tier Justice System, from The Guardian. Then I wrote a commentary, and I try to present about 4 to 5 commentaries a week in the almost 14 hours of live broadcasting I do each week. I'm going to share a commentary that I've written, as well as one from Mike Adams, the Health Ranger, dealing with psychiatry. I will be doing more commentaries on psychiatry as the year goes on. I've just completed all my filming of a major new documentary called Manufacturing Madness that will be out in about 9 months. I'll share that. From our environmental segment today, Poisoning the Well, How the Federal Government Lets Industries Pollute the Nation's Underground Water Supply. This is from Abram Lutzgarden from ProPublica. This is information that is not available anywhere. Very important. And also, regulators under fire for keeping hydrofracking pollution tests secret. And this is especially true in Pennsylvania, where the hydrofracking industry virtually controls the governor and the legislative branch when it comes to fracking there. So as you see, we have a lot to share. Let's begin. Curcumin. If you have cancer, it's definitely one of the nutrients I'm going to recommend that you take in the form of curcuminoids. But what if you're otherwise healthy? What does it do? Some good information. This is published in the British Journal of Nutrition as well as Nutrition Research. It says that curcumin can benefit your cardiovascular health to the same extent as exercise for postmenopausal women. This was a clinical trial from Japan. Now, as we know, vascular health, as measured by what is called flow-mediated dilation, or FMD, improved equally in groups of women receiving curcumin supplements and those receiving aerobic exercise training. In fact, in a recent study from the British Journal of Nutrition, it indicated that the flow-mediated dilation is in a predictor of future adverse cardiovascular events. And so it means that when you're not getting a good flow of blood, that's bad. When you have an exceptional flow of blood, that's excellent. Quote, therefore, regular ingestion of curcumin could be a preventative measure against cardiovascular disease in postmenopausal women. Furthermore, our results suggest that curcumin may be a potential alternative for patients who are unable to exercise. Now, why? We know that curcumin is the yellow pigment that you find in turmeric, which is used in curries. It's what gives it its color. There are over 2,000 studies in the peer-reviewed literature showing the benefit of turmeric and curcumin. We know that it can protect men's prostate. We know that it helps protect the brain against Alzheimer's. It protects against heart failure, diabetes, and arthritis. So on all levels, curcumin is just one of the absolutely best of all the nutrients we can take into our body. A lot of people eat meat. Yesterday, while I was in post-editing to bring out the final version of Seeds of Death, which is now, as of today, done, I've had to go through three post-premiere edits, plus get a trailer, plus give you people's comments as they come out of the theater. All that's done. It'll all be up later today on the website, on this website, and my Facebook and on GaryNall.com. I was given a call. Gary, yeah, why don't you turn on that Man versus Food show? Why? This guy's eating a 5-pound Philadelphia sandwich. So I turned it on, and sure enough, here the guy was eating a 5-pound sandwich. Well, first of all, just the idea of putting that amount of food, meat, into your body, and all that carbohydrate from the bun, and all that saturated fat from the cheese, is just more than the body can handle. It's not, is this guy almost probably going to die of a heart attack or stroke? It's just when. But this becomes new theater. This is the arena of the absurd. This is where someone will gluttonize to cheers and hand pumps and fist pumps. You know, you can do it. Kids, you know, yelling, yes, you're our hero. All the while, you see an ever-expanding girth on this man as he tries to put some of the most toxic foods in the world into his body without ever once commenting upon what is the likely outcome. There's not even a disclaimer that says putting this amount of food or even these types of foods into a person's body could be harmful to your health. But once you start with extremes, then it doesn't take more than about 6 months before the extreme is no longer stimulating enough to cause us to be interested. We have to have something even more extreme. And, of course, all this extreme ends up in death or destruction. And then think of all the people who just couldn't stop the train wrecks, couldn't stop watching them, couldn't stop seeing how close to death people can come. That's a comment about us, not just about the people who are profiting from it. Here's the other story that you could have posted. You could have shown, according to Alternate and Tara Lohan, a 1-year undercover investigation by the Kansas City Star. And they took a look at what happened to Margaret Lampkin, She's been forced to wear a colostomy bag for the rest of her life after a medium-rare steak she ordered 3 years ago at Applebee's was contaminated with a pathogen. The results of that pathogen destroyed her colon. Now, of course, we already know that E. coli and other foodborne pathogens are in meat and chicken and dairy. People have gotten sick to the tune of tens of millions a year in the United States. Thousands die. Everything from E. coli contaminated spinach to peanut butter. But meat is at the top of the list. Here's what it says. Quote, the industry calls bladed or needled beef and found the process exposes Americans to a higher risk of E. coli poisoning than cuts of meat that have not been tenderized. Although blading and injecting marinades into meat add value for the beef industry, they can also drive pathogens, including E. coli 015787, that destroyed Lampkin's colon deeper into the meat. By using this process, which about 90% of all meat processors will use, people are at a greater risk of exposure to life-threatening illness. And consumers have no way of knowing whether their meat has undergone this process. Ending up with a fecal-contaminated burger is bad, but it's just the beginning of what the investigation uncovered. Here are the other points, as McGraw writes in the article. 1. Large beef plants, based upon volume alone, contribute disproportionately to the incidence of meat-borne pathogens. 2. Big beef and other processors are commingling ground beef from many different cattle, some from outside the United States, adding to the difficulty health officials have tracking contaminated products to their source. The industry also has resisted labeling some products, including mechanically tenderized meat, to warn consumers and restaurants to cook it thoroughly. Big beef is injecting millions of dollars of growth hormones and antibiotics into the cattle, partly to fatten them up for market. Many experts believe that years of overuse and misuse of such drugs contributes to antibiotic-resistant pathogens in humans, meaning illnesses once treated with a regimen of antibiotics are much harder to control. Big Beef is using its political pull and public relations campaigns and the support of science it sponsors and pays for to influence federal dietary guidelines and recast steaks and burgers as health foods people should eat every day. It even persuaded the American Heart Association to certify beef as heart healthy. And so that's what people are up to. So just one more reason that you should at least know that what you think you're getting in the beef, you're not aware. You're unaware of where that beef came from, how the beef was treated, what it was fed. Beef can be fed dried blood, newspapers, offal, chicken manure. It can be fed ground up boxes. All kinds of things can go into the pellets they're fed. Now, I've raised cattle. I've had all types of animals rescued and those that are born from being rescued. And I give a place for them to range. For example, from 1989 to 1995, when I owned Healing Springs Ranch, I would take in horses that were otherwise going to be put down and cows that would be put down because they were malnourished. At that time, simply because a lot of farmers didn't have the money to feed them. And then when I would go by their lots to say, why didn't you have enough land? And they would have them all in feed lots. Of course, there's no grass there. And throwing a bale of hay in isn't going to do it. So I'd put them out on 200 acres of beautiful mixtures of clover and rye and buckwheat grasses. And they would, in 2 or 3 months, they would get healthy. And they could, you know, spend their life just grazing and having pure water and socializing in an environment that was healthy for them. Or letting 4-H kid camps adopt them out. But all your hoof stuff are supposed to eat grass, not grains, not sweet grains, not any grains, not pellets. And yet that's what they're feeding them. But they also know that if they give antibiotics to a cow, it'll gain about 10% more weight. Well, that's profit because it's sold by It's sold by the pound. They also know that there are chemicals they can give a beef in the feed that makes them drink more water. Once again, a gallon of water is 9 pounds. So it's very easy to get a lot of cattle water heavy by the time they go into the feedlot and in the slaughterhouse. These are the tricks that are played. But the meat is contaminated. All meat has bacteria. There's no such thing in the world as a non-bacteria-laden piece of meat. You could take any piece of meat in the world, I don't care from what source, and put it under a microscope, do an analysis, and you'll find bacteria. So that's why you should at least be aware of the risk you're willing to go through to eat an unhealthy food. Now, we have been bombarded with negative stories about vitamins don't work or they're dangerous, and these are all industry plants. This is the latest from Case Adams, who is writing for Green Med Info. As you remember, earlier this year there was a study that supposedly showed that multiple vitamins don't have anything to do with cancer. Not true. In fact, Harvard researchers have found that multiple vitamin use over a long period reduces the incidence of many cancers along with death. The researchers conducted a study of male doctors called the Physician's House Study, a randomized controlled trial, and they've been doing this since 1997. There are almost 15,000 doctors in the study. They were 50 years or older at the beginning of the study. The average age is 64. And what they have found is, through this randomized study, the double-blinded study, placebo-controlled study, that multiple vitamin use decreased all types of cancer by 12%, decreased death from all cancers by 12%. And the all-cancer statistics were significantly skewed by the fact that multiple vitamin use only reduced the risk of prostate cancer by 2%, while prostate cancer accounted for half of all the cancer cases among the men. So you have to look at all the cancers. Also, when I looked, these were small doses of vitamins, and they weren't all-inclusive, but still it was positive. So just understand what you read in the newspaper about something working or not working, unless you go to the original studies and see who funded it, the background of each of the people on the study, and then reread the study, you won't know that it, more often than not, it's just to discourage people from taking vitamins. Green tea. Over 5,000 studies in the scientific literature on green tea. Here's the latest, published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. It shows that regular consumption of green tea will reduce the risk of digestive system cancers, and finding that women who drank green tea for prolonged periods of time had a lower incidence of digestive system cancers of the stomach, esophagus, and colorectum. This was done at Vanderbilt University Medical School, led by Dr. Sarah Nechuda, and they examined 75,000 middle-aged and older Chinese women. Quote, for all digestive system cancers combined, the risk was reduced by 27% among women who have been drinking tea regularly. And so that's great. So my suggestion, if you want to reduce your risk of cancer, especially the cancers of the digestive system, glass of green tea each day will do it. Now, we have a lot of Americans who are suffering from anxiety. A lot of ways of dealing with it. This is just one more piece of that puzzle. According to the British Medical Journal, or British Journal of Nutrition, research done at Deakin University as well as the University of Melbourne found that DHA from the omega-3 fatty acids lowers anxiety risk and does so substantially. In fact, the highest intake of DHA was associated with a 50% reduction in the risk of anxiety disorders. So that is terrific. And so that's 50% of those people would not have anxiety. Now, of course, what if they added some other known anti-anxiety like passion flower? or 5-hydroxytryptophan, or how about a St. John's wort? Then they could be reducing their anxiety even more. And finally, complementary medicine does indeed help people with arthritis. This just out from the Journal of Clinical Nursing. This was a major study, and what it showed here at the Faculty of Medicine at the University of St. Joseph, that, quote, our study underlines the importance of healthcare professionals being knowledgeable about the potential of dealing with complementary and alternative therapies when helping people with rheumatoid arthritis and osteoarthritis, shows that indeed it works. So what is it that works? Well, how about this? How about getting rid of the pro-inflammatory atoms in the diet? Hot dogs, hamburgers, french fries, a deep-fried food, colas and coffees, soft drinks. And then how about giving more grains and legumes and beans and nuts and seeds and vegetables and tubers and garlic and onions and vitamin C and the essential fatty acids? All that helps turn off inflammation and heal the joints. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health and nutrition and healing. Now for two commentaries, then we'll take a break, then come back with your talk back where you have an opportunity to call in and share your comments and points of view, which we welcome. That number to call in about 5 minutes is 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Also, we try to post about 50 articles a day, and sometimes it's more than 100. We try to post articles on progressive themes, meaning finding solutions to problems that right now are vexing, that we don't have solutions to. We do not use any political bias or religious bias or scientific bias. We look at what works, and that's what we share with you. So everybody, no matter what your background, can benefit. So please remember that these articles are free. They're definitive. They're always scientifically referenced. And they're there for you as a public service. We also have the largest site in America for progressives to go to on issues such as genetic engineering with hundreds of articles, on vaccination, on food irradiation, on nuclear power, on solar storms, on gas hydrofracking. So we have a wide range of topics that we help sponsor information and get you into groups that you can then offer up support for that cause. I'm sure many people in this audience watch, several men did, over Google, watched the documentary about 5 years ago, produced by Minette Loudon, one of our finest executive producers, called The Drugging of Our Children. I went across the United States filming parents and children. I went down to Washington and filmed legislators. We looked at the scientific literature, and something kept challenging everything I was doing, and that is, how is it that my generation, the baby boomers, never had kids who were committing suicide? In fact, I asked everyone I knew from my hometown. I went back to my hometown. I even found a 90-year-old seventh grade teacher I had, and I asked all of them the same. Do you know of anyone that committed suicide? The answer was no. In fact, it was so rare for anyone to ever die growing up unless someone got hit by a car or there was a gunshot and a hunting accident that once killed someone. There was never suicide. When we went to school, we were expected to behave in school. We were expected to do our homework. We were expected to learn. But here's the reality of life. Not everybody's equally motivated. Not everyone's equally focused. Not everyone's equally bright. It's just that simple. I'm sorry to discourage people who believe we should all be the same, but we're not. I can't do things that other people could easily do. I wished I could take a football and throw it 80 yards, but I can't. And I'm not asking someone to throw it 30 yards, so my throwing it 30 means we're equal. Today, with our desire to overprotect our children from the reality of life, to overparent them, which I see. I mean, I come out of my building and I see parents with six-year-olds in the little carriages, you know, the little things they ride them around in. Why in the world the kid can walk, the kid can run? Why are you having him where you're taking him to places where they're not even up and moving? Why do you have to carry your kid? Overprotected, over-indoctrinated, over-conditioned, over-pampered, over-babied, over-protected, over-idolized, and more often than not, buying love with gifts. And then one day the kid meets the real world, and they're not prepared for it. I saw that too, and I got that feedback from a lot of behaviors and psychologists. Today, 5 years later, almost every kid in the United States is at risk of being diagnosed, and probably within the next year or two, mandatory testing to see whether or not you have a mental disorder that might be hidden. And so for the benefit of Hillary Clinton and her village raising a kid, which I'm absolutely opposed to, let's test every kid. Of course, for the benefit of the kid, not the pharmaceutical company and not the psychiatric industry, but for the kid. Of course, we all know the real truth of this. And we also know that the people on the left will be the first to line up to volunteer their kids. They do for vaccinations. They do for any medication. They do for any form of drugging. And you don't see them challenging it in their media. It is rare, if ever, that they challenge the drugging of anything. And the right's right behind them. So where does this leave the kid? Well, you're an emotional minefield. Why? Because, as I have written and Mike Adams states absolutely correctly, the industry, the psychiatric industry, has officially gone insane. Virtually every emotion experienced by a human being, normal ones, sadness, grief, anxiety, frustration, impatience, excitement, creative insight, joy, pleasure, is now being classified as a mental disorder, which then demands treatment with, of course, prescription medication. Why can I say this with such certainty? Because I have looked at, and you will certainly shortly have, the DSM-5, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Psychiatry. That is a psychiatric Bible. It'll be released in a few months, and it's transformed itself from a medical reference manual to a treatment to the insanity of the industry itself. Mental disorders, named in the DSM-5 General Anxiety Disorder, or GAD for short, can be diagnosed in a person who feels a little anxious doing something like talking to a psychiatrist. Thus, the mere act of a psychiatrist engaging in the possibility of making a diagnosis causes the symptoms of the diagnosis to magically appear. This is called quack science. It is fraudulent science. It is perverse science. It is inhumane science. This is a crime against humanity. And these frauds, these psychiatrists, the entire industry should be held accountable, but so should your general physician who's using it also. And with circular reasoning, yet it's indicative of the entire industry of psychiatry, which has come to a point where it is such a laughingstock among actual science that even the scientific skeptics are starting to turn their backs in disgust. Psychiatry is no more scientific than astrology or palm reading. Yet as practitioners call themselves doctors of psychiatry in order to try to make quackery sound credible. Let me explain how it works. Here's how modern psychiatry really operates. A relatively small group of self-important, self-selected, overpaid pseudo-intellectuals who want to make more money invent a fabricated illness or disease it then calls hubba hubba disorder. By a show of hands, they then vote into existence whatever symptoms they wish to associate with hubba hubba disorder. In this case, the symptoms might be spontaneous singing, or wanting to blow your nose in a public place, or maybe stroking your hair in a movie theater. Then they convince teachers, journalists, and government regulators that Hoba-Hoba disease is real and important and that millions of children suffer from it. And it wouldn't be compassionate not to offer all those children treatment, would it? Thus begins the call for treatment for a completely fabricated disease. From there, it's just one step to get Big Pharma to fabricate whatever scientific data they need in order to prove that speed, amphetamines, pharmaceutical crack, or whatever poison they wish to sell reduces the risk of Hoba-Hoba disorder. Serious-sounding psychiatrists who are all laughing their asses off in the back room then diagnose children with Hoba-Hoba disorder and prescribe the prescription drugs that claim to treat it. For this action, these psychiatrists, who are, let us just admit it, dangerous child predators, earn financial kickbacks from Big Pharma. And we know what kind of human cesspool Big Pharma is. In order to maximize their kickbacks from Big Pharma and the freebies, groups of these psychiatrists get together every few years and invent more fictitious disorders, expanding their fictitional tome called the Diagnostic Statistical Manual. The DSM is now larger than ever and includes disorders such as obedience defiance disorder. Well, I got to hold my head up and hand up and stand up. I'm guilty and been guilty my whole life of obedience defiance disorder. Oh, hold on. Gee whiz, that must make me insane. Well, I guess. But that would make then everyone from my generation that protested in the Vietnam War and for women's rights and against apartheid in South Africa and apartheid, which has never stopped, in 67 in Israel, and we would be insane for protesting on behalf of the poor and environmental and gas and nuclear and against the abuses. Are there any other of the CIA? It's all abusive. And against the lies and betrayal of every president. Is there a disorder when the president uses drugs and then turns around and criminalizes anyone else who does it, but not themselves? Wouldn't it be nice if all the presidents, all of them, Bush and Clinton, well, he didn't inhale, so he would go to a halfway house, so we're told. I'm sure he never penetrated either. Oh, well. And Obama, what if they all went to prison and held their cabinet meetings with other ones who should be in prison with him in jail? Now, I'd like to see that. I'd like to see every president in jail doing their business from jail. Now, of course, they can have their perks. They wouldn't have to worry about bending over and taking a shower unless they wanted to, and who knows. But no, everybody else goes to jail, but the rich and powerful don't. They just write best-selling books about how they were druggies, but now they're really putting 27 years of your life behind bars if you smoke marijuana in Florida. That's really not hypocrisy. Is there a disorder for that in any way? I'm just curious. So let's just see. So my whole generation should go to jail immediately, or at least go to a psychiatric institution, at least go over to Bellevue and admit it. Hold your hand up and say, I'm brain disordered. I'm a psychiatric refugee. I'm an obedience defiance disorder person. All of Pacifica, all of BAI, all of anyone that I know, anyone that I've met, all the activists, all the people with conscientious objections to anything, we're all obedient. But then again, so were the presidents of the United States up through at least 1847 or 8. All the founding fathers of the United States suffered from obedience defiance disorder because if psychiatry was really vibrant back then and had the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, they would have labeled all these people, you're opposing and you're defiant to the King of England. How dare you? You're mentally disturbed. Franklin, Roosevelt. Now, of course, we've got to throw Bill O'Reilly in there. He won't like that, will you, Billy? No, Billy, we'll throw some people with loaf of sponges in there with you. And Glenn Beck, Glenn, we'll put you in there. We'll put you in a vault with lots of money and mirrors, and you can hear yourself talk and look at yourself all day long and play on your money. Do you know anyone who's ever done anything important in life who is not defiant? I don't. I can't name a person. But now, just so you understand, in the new lexicon, if you're defiant at any point against any authority for any reason, irrespective of the legitimacy, you're now susceptible to being diagnosed with obedience defiance disorder because you're refusing to kiss the boots, at least the one boot that's still on the ground while the other's on the back of your neck. Oh, that's our National Defense Authorization Act. That's Homeland Security Act. That putrid human scum that we call Congress, those are the authority figures. But none of them are to be diagnosed with anything except greed disorder, small penis disorder. That's who these people are that we voted into office. My God, I don't blame them for being the idiots, greedy little bastards they are. I mean, you shove off your lawn better crap than we find in our Congress. We're the ones to blame for that. Not them. They're just being themselves. They're the parasites that take advantage. So that's where we're at now. And also, you can also get diagnosed with hoarding disorder if you happen to stockpile food and water and survival gear. Yes. If you're conscientious about the future, they can diagnose you with hoarding. So let's say you had a water filter or you had backup food because of maybe Hurricane Sandy. They don't care about Hurricane Sandy or Katrina. They don't care about earthquake, tsunami. All they care about is, you're a hoarder. We got you. Now we can institutionalize you. We can force you to take drugs. Yep. Being prepared for possible natural disaster now makes you a mental patient in the eyes of modern psychiatry and the government. Alan Francis chaired the DMS-IV that was released in 1994. He now admits it was a huge mistake that has resulted in the mass overdiagnosis of people who are actually very normal. Quote, inadvertently, the DMS-IV contributed to three false epidemics, attention deficit disorder, autism, and childhood bipolar disorder, end quote. That is what the former chair of the DMS-IV committee stated on the record. Did you hear about that? Not at all. He goes on to say, quote, the first draft of the next edition of the Diagnostic Statistical Manual is filled with suggestions that would multiply our mistakes and extend the reach of psychiatry's dramatically deeper into the ever-shrinking domain of the normal. This wholesale medical imperialism of normality could potentially create tens of millions of innocent bystanders who would be mislabeled as having a mental disorder. The pharmaceutical industry would have a field day, despite the lack of solid evidence of any effective treatment for these newly proposed diagnoses. All these fabricated disorders, of course, result in false positive diagnosis. The psychosis risk syndrome would use the presence of strange thinking to predict who would later have a full-blown psychotic episode, but the prediction would be wrong at least three or four times for every time it is correct, and many misidentified teenagers who receive medications that can cause enormous weight gain, diabetes, and shortening of life expectancy, end quote. But that's the whole point of psychiatry, to prescribe drugs to people who don't need them. This is accomplished almost entirely by diagnosing people with disorders they do not have, that do not exist. And it culminates in psychiatrists being paid money they never earned and certainly don't deserve. Just imagine an entire industry invented out of nothing. And yes, you do have to imagine it because nothing inside the industry is actually real. The only way to be normal when being observed or diagnosed by a psychiatrist, a process that is entirely subjective and completely devoid of anything resembling actual science, is to exhibit absolutely no emotions or behavior whatsoever. In effect, become an emotionless zombie. A person in a coma is a normal person, according to the DSM, because they don't exhibit any symptoms that might indicate the presence of those gullible things called emotions or behavior. A person in a grave is also normal, according to psychiatry, mostly because dead people do not qualify for Medicare reimbursements and therefore aren't worth diagnosing or medicating. It's all a cruel, complete hoax. Psychiatry is a complete and total fraud. I challenge any psychiatrist who disagrees with me, which you have a right to do, to come on my show and debate me, just you and I. I will be respectful. I will give you absolute the same equal time. But I want to see you come out of the closet or up out of the pit that your motley little disgusting group live in, come on this program and debate me. You have an open invitation. I'm Gary Knoll. Those are my thoughts. Now I'm interested in yours. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888.
Out where they say, let us be gay, I'm going Hollywood. I'll ballyhoo things to you, I'm going Hollywood. Hey, while you sleepy heads are in that hay, I'll be dancing. I'm going to be dancing with a sun-kissed baby, and I'm on my way. Here's my beret. I'm going Hollywood.
Bye. Bye. Nice to have you with us, everyone. Let's go to our guest who's standing by, and then we'll go to your calls. My guest from Turin, Italy, is Dr. Alessio Pisani, a P-I-S-A-N-I. He is a clinical psychologist specializing in psychosomatic medicine and psychoimmunology in Turin, Italy. And while working towards his doctorate and studying the history of cancer, he was introduced to the HIV-AIDS debate and later developed a close association with one of the world's leading medical researchers in alternative therapies, Dr. Marco Ruggiero, in the Department of Pathology and Oncology at the University there. As a psychotherapist, he has worked with many HIV-positive patients, and through his analytical work, he has witnessed some amazing results in the mind-body relationship when a person is given a positive HIV diagnosis. Nice to have you with us today.
Good morning. Good morning.
Would you please give us an understanding of what happens to a person's emotions when they're given an HIV diagnosis, the psychosomatic impact, and then what you've been able to do through your psychotherapeutic work with HIV patients, and how they can become well, no longer with HIV, after counseling? This is very important, and it's really revolutionary.
Of course, Gary. Well, actually, what I found working with patients who had been diagnosed as HIV positive is nothing more. It's not so different from what happens with people diagnosed with cancer, as far as fear of dying is concerned. What is totally different is the social impact and the depressive reactions concerning the relationship with the world, with the outside world. I want to explain it a little bit better. A cancer patient is seen as a victim, so he's going to have a lot of social support. This is not going to happen for an HIV-positive person, because it seems like cancer is just a disgrace, and HIV is something that you looked for, in a way. So if we speak about psychology, clinical psychology, it's a similar at the moment of the diagnosis, because the person is really shocked and is really afraid to die. But it's totally different in the way that the psychopathology is going to develop. I have seen many patients coming to visit me for counseling and psychotherapy, and what I was really surprised of is that those people are and were and still are actually in totally good shape and totally good health. So they started questioning me, asking me how was it possible to have a deadly virus but feeling all right, despite, of course, anxiety or panic attacks or reactive depression. So I started to put my mind to it, and I started talking with many medical doctors, my colleagues that worked with me in the hospital. And this is actually the first approach that I had to this matter, even though when I was studying at the university here in Italy, a clinical psychology master study also biology and genetics, so I was not totally new to this subject. And I had I've always had many doubts about the truth, about the reality of this situation, because it didn't make much sense to me. And working with these people, with these HIV-positive patients, I have had many confirmations about my doubts. And also I started studying the literature, and I also met Luc Montagnier a few months ago. He was here in Turin, Italy, for a conference, and it was really interesting to get the chance to question him about a few aspects that the scientific community called the dissident scientific community has been questioning not only Luc Montagnier but all the orthodoxy, and never got a satisfying answer. And this is exactly what happened to me as well. Luc Montagnier tried to answer my questions, and they were very simple questions. I asked him for an article showing why antibodies in this single and particular case are not a sign of immunization. And I asked him something about the PCR technique. And he said something, but it was not convincing at all. And also other medical students and medical doctors that were present were something like laughing at his answers. So I think we should try, and we must go on spreading the truth, because this is not something that people don't know. I mean, now we have the internet, we have amazing documentaries like House of Numbers, and they are spreading around the world. So I think that the best way to save a person's life is to speak out the truth. I could never have a patient, an HIV-positive patient, in front of me, and I mean, it would be like being a liar if I would not tell him the truth and would not show him the articles which demonstrate, in a way, that there is not one single scientific proof about this situation. And I have seen patients recovering from depression and anxiety and panic disorders by simply speaking out the truth, which is not my opinion, which is not Professor Ruggiero's opinion or Professor Peter Duesberg's opinion, but it's a scientific evidence. And I think that in such a dangerous situation, a psychologically dangerous situation, the best way to help a person diagnosed as HIV positive is to tell him or her the simple truth. I have seen many psychopathologies disappear by simply speaking out the truth.
Okay, so I have a question for you. I'm going to ask for a yes or no answer. Then once you give the answer, it can go into greater detail. You have worked and counseled people who've come to you with a HIV/AIDS diagnosis, yes or no?
Yes.
Okay. Have you seen any of those patients who've been fully medically treated, diagnosed, who've had HIV positive and AIDS diagnosis, reverse their HIV, reverse their AIDS diagnosis with the type of talk therapy and positive affirmations that you've provided, yes or no?
Yes.
And what percentage of the patients that you have seen by getting them to, A, as you said, tell them the truth by showing them that AIDS is not a death sentence, and then giving them positive reinforcement, working at the emotional level, the spiritual level, the nutritional level, and that, by the way, that's one of the things Luc Montagnier has stated repeatedly. In fact, he has stated, and I played the clip, that if I can find the clip, I'll play the clip again, where he said and was quoted that he knows that if you get antioxidants and clean water and good nutrition, you can reverse HIV, go HIV negative. And that would undermine the entire AIDS paradigm. But the trouble is, the entire AIDS paradigm is based upon his original discovery, and Robert Gallows, he won the Nobel Prize for this. So what does it mean when a man says you can reverse HIV out of your body completely, reverse AIDS completely by having antioxidants, clean water, good nutrition, and he said
right.
it twice.
Yeah.
Is that your understanding or not, and have you seen that, yes or no?
Yes.
Okay, good. Do we have a clip? We're going to find this clip. So give us one point of example of someone you've worked with who has been independently diagnosed and has full confirmation that they're HIV positive with AIDS that you have seen with positive psychotherapy reverse their condition based upon mind-body relationship in a positive way.
Yes. I have just one of the last patients that I have been following as a clinical psychologist. She's a very young woman, and she was diagnosed HIV positive something like 1 year ago. And the biggest shock for her was that her partner, her boyfriend, came out HIV negative. She had no risk factor. In the beginning, she didn't know the truth about HIV. She learned that. I helped her to understand the reality hidden behind this supposed virus. And when she went to the hospital and they confirmed with a PCR, so-called viral load test, that she was HIV positive, she insisted and she cried. She screamed at the doctor, "This is not possible. I have done nothing to get this virus." And the doctors didn't even listen to her. They told her, you don't have to ask yourself how you got HIV, because you have it, and this is the only thing you must be concerned about, and to get drugs that are going to save your life. So they didn't even give her the chance to explain and to tell her story. They were not interested in her sexual anamnesis. And so she came to me, she was totally shocked, she couldn't sleep, she was losing her hair because of the stress. She had something like, it's a reaction that we often see in people treated for cancer. They lose their hair because it's a consequence of the immune suppression. This is just an example to tell you the psycho-immunological reaction that this woman had. She was losing her hair, she lost weight, she couldn't sleep, she didn't want to eat anymore. She came to me for a psychotherapy, and I asked her story. I also invited her boyfriend to come and tell me their story. And little by little, it became clear that the medical doctors in the hospital who were following her for the HIV diagnosis only tried to scare her to death. And this was happening because she wanted to commit suicide. Little by little, I would say after 2 or 3 months, I started to give her some scientific references. I started to tell her that the so-called HIV tests are not validated against a gold standard, which would be the famous isolation and purification of HIV. And then, working with her, I could say that she almost totally recovered from the psychosomatic symptoms, which included nauseas, which included dizziness, which included panic attacks, in 2 or 3 months, by simply helping her to find out the scientific evidence about her supposed viral infection, she started little by little to recovery. And then what came out after that, because she was becoming more and more powerful, we had to work a lot about the feelings of rage that she had against all the medical establishment. In the beginning, she wanted to take the doctors to court for a trial, and But I explained her that this rage was totally understandable, but was a toxic emotion as well. She was okay. moving from the toxic emotions caused by the diagnosis to the toxic emotions of rage against
Dr. Alicia, we're running out of time real quick. So that woman today has been retested, and she is HIV negative and AIDS free.
She retested after 11 months, I think, something like that, 1 year more or less, and she tested negative.
Okay, here is a one-minute clip from the man who won the Nobel Prize for discovering the HIV virus, Luc Montagnier. Listen carefully.
We can be exposed to HIV many times without being chronically infected. Our immune system will get rid of the virus within a few weeks if you have a good immune system.
If you have a good immune system, then your body can naturally get rid of HIV.
Yes.
If you take a poor African who's been infected and you build up their immune system, is it possible for them to also naturally get rid of it?
I would think so.
That's an important...
Okay, well, you just heard him. Yet that is not anywhere in any discussion, in any of the age group or any of the scientific community, which would completely wash away the entire AIDS edifice as we know it. Thank you very much. We'll have you back for an extended interview. I want to go into greater depth, but we don't have time today, on some of the other issues in your conversations over there with Dr. Marco Ruggiero from the Department of Pathology and Oncology, University of Firenze. Thank you very much, Dr. Alicia Pisani. Nice to have you with us today. I'm Gary Knoll, and that's just one of the upcoming discussions in depth we're going to have on our conversation with Remarkable Minds. But here's the good news. If you go to our website today or my Facebook or GaryKnoll.com or ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, we have 2,635 great scientists, physicians, Nobel Prize winners around the world and their curricula vitae and statements from a lot of those challenging different aspects of how AIDS is diagnosed and how it's treated. He's just giving you one example of how he reversed in his patients HIV and AIDS by positive reinforcement and on the brain mind body connection. Let's say hello to Flory from Miami. Hi, Flory.
Hi, Gary. Thank you for this part of the show. I am totally agreeing with you in the part of the psychiatry. I must say that I am witness of the fraud on the first row with red carpet. I come from a background of bulimia and sugar addiction, and for years they treated me with any medication under the market. Nothing ever did a thing for me, including the 12-step rooms. And the longest recovery I ever experienced was when I was off that. Then I had a recent fallback, and I am amazed how family members put so much pressure to go back to the psychiatry office and take medications again to went well. And over my dead body, that ain't happening again. But it's funny that somebody like you can see the fraud, and it's right there, and people don't see it. They just believe them. Thank you, Gary.
Thank you. Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I just heard, I got word here that you have, in fact, been seen in movie theaters stroking your hair. And I will also tell you that I would easily, and you would easily, be diagnosed with preoccupation with health syndrome.
Mm-hmm. Preoccupation with health syndrome? I'm guilty.
Mm-hmm. We're going to definitely need to medicate you, Gary.
That's what they keep suggesting.
That's all there is to it. Well, I have an email here. I don't know if I have time to read it.
Yeah, go ahead.
It says, this is from Louise. She used to live in New York. She's been gone for almost 20 years. She says, my mom would send me each week a box of tapes of your shows. For the last 8.5 years, I've been listening via the Internet. First, I want to thank you on behalf of my mother. She is 87 years old. She listens to you since you were on radio. No matter what she is doing each day, she listens. What's interesting is when she first came to see you, you were a best-selling author, and you were lecturing with Carlton Fredericks and Adele Davis at the New York Coliseum. She had suffered excruciating pains in her joints for over 10 years, and she was counseled by Carlton and Adele. She did not know where you were, but she said you came out in an all-white suit, long hair, and you were exuberant and funny. you turned her head around because everything she was doing was wrong. High protein diet, taking B vitamins and fiber, but everything else Carlton Fredericks had her on was causing inflammation and she didn't know it. After the lecture, no one came up to speak with you, but you counseled my mom for about an hour. And it just made sense to her, what you suggested, and within a week, all of her bad acne and all of her aches and pains were gone. And my mom looks and feels 30 years younger than her age. In fact, she doesn't have any old friends because she doesn't like being around them. All they talk about is getting old and dying and how depressed they are. She goes tango dancing 3 times a week. Her question is this. I came by your office with my mom to pick up the 3-hour CD on When Disaster Strikes. And her mom was 100% prepared for the hurricane. Backup fuel, extra food, propane generator. When the power went out all around her, she still had some power because of that. In fact, she was supplying food and water to her neighbors. When we visited you and then went to your store, my mom was hoping to see you, but you were out lecturing. I looked around and I was amazed at this beehive of creativity and social activism. We spoke with several of the people who work with you. Do you ever think about what will happen when all you have created is gone? Are you aware of what part of the chapter you're living in your life right now? I've heard you say thousands of times that everything has an expiration date. I know you had a place in New Jersey, Texas, and upstate New York. All those are gone. You used to be on ABC, and you chose to leave it. How does all this impact you emotionally? Would you share with us what changes you would be making in the near future and what changes we should be making? And is there a larger chapter that all of us should be looking at that is closing, or is everything personal? In other words, are there universal lessons to be learned?
Here's what I'd like to do. That's going to require a rather comprehensive answer, but it's a very good question. No one's ever asked me that before, and I'll be happy to answer it on the Sunday night show, this coming Sunday night, because I have no guest, and I have plenty of time. And I'll take that call early on in the show, and then hopefully I can give an answer that will make sense to her and other people in the audience about when is it time to appreciate that this chapter in your life is over and you have to start another chapter. I'll deal with that on Sunday night, all right?
Okay.
Good. Because normally Utrice Lead would be coming running on right now, and I don't want to take any time away from her. She starts in 20 seconds. Thanks a lot, Luann. I look forward to sharing with everyone on Sunday night, 8 p.m., right here on the Progressive Radio Network on our talkback show. Have a nice day, everyone.
Full of song.